Hey, everybody, Alan Arnett here with another episode on the podcast at alanarnett.com. It's the weekend update for Everest 2022. It is Sunday, April the 10th. Well, a lot has happened in this past week. One of the big things is we had our first summits of the season on an 8,000 meter mountain. And also the number of permits that have been issued have really picked up on Everest. And plus throughout the Khumbu, there seems to be a lot of trekkers this year, which is really good news for everybody that's in the business of tea houses, from supplying goods to whatever happens to be in Nepal. So very happy for Nepal, seeing its tourism start to recover after a pretty tough last two, 3 years. You know, the big picture is that that the permits did pick up as expected. It looks like now, as of April the 8th, so a couple of days ago, that they've issued, the Ministry of Tourism has issued 505 total climbing permits. And of those, 204 are for Everest. So I still think we're on track to be between 250 and 300, albeit down from the 408 in 2021, but still a good number, which will give a lot of people an opportunity to have an experience of a lifetime, but also for the Sherpas to have work, the yak herders, the tea houses, and everybody else to maybe make some money this season. And also, as I mentioned last week, or maybe some other times, that there's a lot of efforts going on this year to help remove a lot of the trash on all of the 8,000 meter mountains this year, headed up by the Nepal Army, and just so happy to see Nepal really taking seriously the need to keep the Khumbu and these mountains as clean as possible. A lot of teams arrived this past week. That's what drove the permits up. And so there's still more to come. So that's the reason we're expecting to see more permits issued. And then also they have flown into Lukla or into Namche, and they've started the trek up to Everest Base Camp. And I'm going to walk through part of that trek at the end of this podcast. The Icefall Doctors, they've got the route in to Camp 2. And we're getting different reports on how many ladders there are in the Khumbu Icefall. You know, at the end of the day, the fewer the ladders, the faster the Sherpas can go. So that's, you know, that's really, really good news if they can have as few as possible. I'm hearing reports of 4, but I've also heard 12. So we'll give this a couple more weeks to get some people up there to find out, you know, what's really happening. Lots of teams are acclimatizing on the way up to Everest Base Camp. Dave Pritt over at Adventure Peaks told me that his team, they summited Lobache East, which is a very popular mountain. It's about 20,000 feet. It's not that difficult, but you're getting that altitude and you're working your body, and that creates those red blood cells and it accelerates the acclimatization process. IMG has also got their team all set up to do that, and several other teams do as well. I posted a great picture that Josh Garrison, who's climbing with Madison Mountaineering, took at the entrance of going into Sagarmatha National Park of just, I mean, there's just a lot of people. On one hand, you look at that and you say, oh my gosh, look how many people are there. On the other hand, you look at it and go, oh my gosh, look how many people are there. And you know, I look at it and I see two things. One is I see a renewal of tourism in the Khumbu. I see money for the locals, as I've already said, but I also see a bunch of people there just really enjoying themselves, and they are about to experience some lifetime views that will change their life, whether they're trekking to Everest Base Camp, or they're trekking to Gokyo, or they're going in to climb Island Peak, or Brunse, or even Mount Everest. But they all are in for a real, real treat. Let's see. So moving on over, Pimba at 8K Expeditions. He told me of a really unique climber that he has on his team, 35-year-old Kristen Harala from Norway. So last year, she set what the Guinness World Book of Records gave her credit for was the fastest female climb of Everest and Lhotse peak to peak in 12 hours. In other words, she went from the summit of Everest to the summit of Lhotse in 12 hours. And apparently that was some kind of a female record. So, you know, really happy for her, proud of that. But she took that accomplishment. And if you go to her website, I've got the link on the blog. If you go to her website, she talks about how all of a sudden she realized, hey, I may have a knack for this. You know, she was a cross-country skier, but she now calls herself a mountaineer, a runner, and a skier. And so she has set a goal that she calls, let's see, make sure I get this exactly right. She calls Women 2, 14 Peak Project. And what that is that she's going to go try to climb all 14 of the 8,000 meter mountains in the next 6 or 7 months. So Pemba Sherpa, again, of AK Expeditions, apparently is handling her logistics. And so the first grouping were all the ones in Nepal. It's going to be Dalagari, Kanchenjunga, Everest, Lhotse, Makalu, Annapurna. She's on Annapurna right now. And then the second phase are over in Pakistan, Nanga Parbat, the Gasher Brahms 1 and 2, Broad Peak and K2. Of course, that leaves Shishapangma. And China has closed Shish to all foreigners, or closed Tibet to all foreigners. So it's going to be another difficult logistics miracle for her to get in there and climb that. So moving on to the other 8,000 meter mountains, Mingma Ji of Imagine Nepal, you know, he continues to do some wild and impressive things. He got a group of 10 members supported by 12 Sherpas to the summit of Dalagiri. That's the seventh highest peak in the world at 26,795 feet or 8,167 meters, seventh highest. You know, what was most interesting to me was that a lot of these climbers, they arrive a week to 10 days ago, and then they go to the summit. So this is kind of showing that there's a whole new formula on climbing these 8,000 meter mountains. You know, if you went back maybe 10 years ago, you just wouldn't see the traffic on these 8,000 meter mountains that you do today. But what has happened is that these Sherpa-owned companies like Mingma, Seven Summits Treks, 8K Expeditions, they have discovered that there's a formula that they can make money, and also they can put people on top of these big 8,000 meter mountains. The way they do it is that first off, they have incredibly strong Sherpas. The Sherpas go up and they break the trail. They put the fixed line in on well-known and proven routes. They establish the high camps with tents and stoves, oxygen, fuel. Sometimes they even carry the members sleeping bags and pads. Once the route is set to the summit, then that opens the gate for the members. And basically they move up the mountain, they clip into the fixed line set by the Sherpas, and they follow the boot path to the top. Normally these days, most of them are climbing on highly efficient oxygen delivery systems running at 4 liters a minute or more in some cases. Now, not everybody does this. Other people are there on the mountain. They're not using the same logistics like a Mingma Ji would be. For example, Carlos Soroya at 83 years old is there, and he's there with a small team climbing independently. But still, they're going to benefit from that fixed rope being put in and having that boot path put in. I promise you, it's easier to climb in an existing boot path than it is to break the snow. And that's what makes a lot of this so impressive, is that these Sherpas, let's say you got 5 or 6 Sherpas on a rope fixing team, they take turns, you know, breaking trail, fixing the rope, but they take turns because genetically they're strong and they have proven that they can do this much, much faster than, you know, someone like me, which doesn't stand a chance to do what they do. But don't get me wrong. I'm not necessarily criticizing this as a style, because frankly, that's what the industry has turned into, and there's a market for it. But I do know that, you know, this style of climbing is just distasteful for many of the purest armchair climbers, journalists, old timers, if you will. You know, they call it mountain tourism, and I'm not sure that's not the correct term for it. You know, the way I look at it is that there's two different categories, two different groupings. The first group I'll call a recreational climber. That's someone like me. I call myself a recreational climber. I'm not out there trying to set any records or to prove anything to anybody. I climb for the love of climbing. And also, you know, I do have my other reasons around Alzheimer's advocate and things like that, that I use my climbing as a way to raise awareness. But basically, I'm a recreational climber. The other group that I put are the record seekers. Those are people that are determined purposefully to go and try to set a new record, an age record, a speed record, an unclimbed mountain, a new route on a climbed mountain, whatever it is. And, you know, I do, however, think the style applies to both groups. So, for example, I'm totally against using a helicopter flying to Camp 2 on Everest. I think if you can't go through the icefall, if it's too dangerous for you, then you shouldn't be there. That's an example of style that I would say. Using oxygen, that's completely up in the air, and there are hard entrenched views on both sides of that. Personally, I don't have a problem with people using oxygen. People who don't use oxygen in summit, they have got my total admiration. They are different than other people. Genetically, they're different. But here's the deal is that I think if you go and you climb a mountain and just say you're going to set a record, you go climb this mountain on a standard route using oxygen in the boot path on the fixed rope that somebody else put in, and you do it in such a way that it appears to be a record. And then you tell the world that you just set a record, whatever it is, whether you climbed one or 14 or seven or, you know, did it four in the fastest, whatever it happens to be. That's a little different style than maybe 10 years earlier, 20 years earlier, if you claim you broke that previous record. And this is where I think it gets sticky, is that if you did it by a completely different style, you claim a new record, and you don't acknowledge that you use completely different techniques, more advanced techniques, you use the tools of the trade which are available for you today that perhaps weren't available before. I'm not saying you don't deserve to claim a record. What I am saying is that I want you to acknowledge that you did it in a different way that had advantages that the previous person that had the record did. But, you know, climbing mountains, it's not the Olympics. There's no rules to it. There's no real governing party that determines what's a record and what's not a record. At the end of the day, it comes down to personal integrity for each person to claim what their accomplishment for what they did. And, you know, where it turns ugly is when you claim that record, but you don't acknowledge those that you climbed on the shoulders of. So enough of that rant. Looking forward next week, the everybody's going to be arriving at base camp. They're going to be establishing a new home. Some people will be over on Lobache. There'll be people that'll be flying into Lukla and starting the trek for the first time. I bet we'll hear that the ropes are up to Camp 3 sometime next week, assuming the weather cooperates. You know, usually it's pretty good through mid-May or out through all of May, but then it turns ugly in early June. So they hope to get the ropes in by the end of May. And if they do, then that'll open up the gates for whenever the weather window appears for people to start climbing. You know, with only, let's say, 300 people, only 300 climbers plus 300 Sherpas supporting them, actually be more than that, because these days the ratio has gone from maybe 0.8 Sherpa to one member. Now it's 1.2 Sherpas for every one member. So in other words, you'll have 300 members, but you may have, let's say, 340 or 360 Sherpas supporting them. There'll be more Sherpas than members that'll summit. Still, you've got 600 people, and let's hope it's not like 2019, where we only had 3 days of good weather. Let's hope this year's more like 2018, where there were 11 days of good weather. Also, let's hope those typhoons, you know, they kind of wait and bide their time down in the Bay of Bengal and hit into the monsoon season in the normal normal June instead of coming in May. So that's the update for last week and what we expect coming up. But, you know, one of the things that I'm following, and I just love watching this, are the people doing the trek through the Khumbu, especially people for their first time there. I'm a broken record, and, you know, it'll change your life if you ever get a chance to go. And I really believe that. Typically, it's about a 7 to 8 day trek. If you go to the blog, you'll see I've got a nice map that shows what it looks like to trek through there. And it really is just an amazing time. Right now, the rhododendrons and the cherry trees are all blossoming. The temperatures are pretty reasonable. You know, it'll start off cold in the morning. You'll have a down jacket on when you leave a tea house. But typically people, they're going from, let's do the route today, going from Pak Ding to Namche, all the way up to the Pengbalche Monastery. You know, you leave Pak Ding, you get up pretty early in the morning, around 6 o'clock, you have a relaxed breakfast. You know, typically it's going to be, you know, toast and eggs and, you know, whatever they consider to be coffee. Most of the time it'll be tea. Hopefully it'll be milk tea. That's always my favorite. I just love to drink the milk tea in the Khumbu. But, you know, but the big deal is that going between Pak Ding and Namche is that you've got to go up the so-called Namche Hill. You know, okay, cue the music, do. But the Namche Hill is about 2,000 feet of going through the forest, and it can be incredibly hot, but you're gaining a lot of altitude in a relatively short period of time. But before you get there, you're going to go just winding through right above the trail, right above the Dodicoce River. You're going to go through some beautiful villages. You're going to see some wonderful kids running up and down the trail. There's going to be the old ladies in the potato fields out there farming in their beautiful, beautiful dresses, you know, but they've got one eye on their kids the entire time. Like most moms, they've got eyes in the back of their heads. You know, the men are out there working, being typically mountain guides. Those are the traditional roles in the Khumbu, and they're pretty well entrenched these days. But you're going to go through and just experience seeing that. You're going to hear the rushing water down in the river below, the kids laughing, the women talking in the fields. It's like sensory overload of just seeing and hearing, smelling the rhododendrons, and just feeling the dirt path underneath your feet, knowing that literally there have been millions of footsteps on the same trail for centuries. You're really in a special, special spot. You come and go through the river, go across a couple of bridges, and then you get to one right at the base of the Gnamchi Hill. And this one is a steel cable bridge, so it's incredibly well built. It's a relatively new one, as I say relative, because it was built maybe 30 years ago, whereas the one before it was way up higher. And so the Gnamchi Hill, for those of you that have been there, as hard as you may have thought it was, it used to be much, much harder when they had a higher up bridge, and basically the trail went literally almost straight up, as I'm told. Never was there, but that's how I'm told. Today, that bridge that you're going to go across to get to the base of the new Gnamchi Hill, there's prayer flags, and they are covered all over kind of the uphill side to the climber's right as you cross that bridge, covered with these beautiful prayer flags. All the five colors are right there. They're always in the same color left to right. There's blue, white, red, green, and yellow. And they represent blue is the sky, white is the air, red is fire, green is water, and yellow is earth. But, you know, and you get to that bridge and you just see them flapping in the breeze, because there's kind of a venturi effect with the wind coming down these really tall rock walls that define the valley that the Dodicoce has carved out over the centuries. And the wind's coming down, the prayer flags are flapping. There might be a zoe come across the bridge, which you've always got to give them the right of way. You do not want to be on a bridge when a zoe, a yak, or a mule train comes through. Believe me, you don't want to do that. So you bide your time and wait for them to come across, no matter how slow the bovines are moving. Take that time just to let it all sink in. You know, it's a good time to be in a traffic jam when you can stand there and still hear in the river and the prayer flags flapping. You go across that bridge and then you start going up the Gnamchi Hill. You know, it's one of those things where you think you're in great shape, but this is probably your first real test. And, you know, the trick here is that you're still acclimatizing. You're going to gain 2,724 feet between Pakting and Gnamchi. That's a pretty aggressive gain for the day. So you take it slow, you know, step by step. You know, you kind of downshift the gear, short, simple steps. It's a very wide dirt path. There's mule trains coming by. There's zoes coming by. There'll be the porter that come by that you'll look at, and you'll just won't understand how this small human being can carry such a big load, just admiring the hard work that they put in, you know, to earn money for themselves and their family. The trail winds through the road, through the trees, and all of a sudden you look off to your right and see a bunch of people standing off to the climber's right. Well, you walk up and join them. There's a little gap in the trees, and oh my gosh, there's Mount Everest. It's the first time you're actually going to see Everest in, you know, kind of with your bare eye. And typically this early, the jet stream is still sitting on top of it. So this plume is just flying off, going from left to right, going from east to west. And the plume is huge. And you just kind of get a sense for how big this mountain is when you're sitting at around, you know, 9,000 feet. And you're thinking this thing is 20,000 feet higher than you are right now. So you probably take too long standing there looking at it, but eventually you leave and you take a couple more hours to get into Gnamchi. You know, at one time, Gnamchi was just a sleepy little village with all these homes that were built. They were hand-built with stones that were carved from a local quarry. In fact, it's just over the hill from where Gnamchi is. And right, if you know where the helicopter pad is, that quarry is right there. It's really always a treat to go there and see people, you know, digging out these rocks and with chisels and hammers, making them perfectly square so they can build the walls of these homes and these buildings and these tea houses. But you know, NOMSI has really changed. In the old days, what you used to have, old days being, let's say, before 2000, so 20 odd years ago, there was a few nice bakeries, which are still there. There were stunning views, comfortable tea houses, all of that's there. But now NOMSI has really become the center of the Khumbu. It's the capital of the Khumbu, if you will. They even have a hotel tax now that you have to pay. So, you know, they've joined the ranks of Vail and Aspen and the Tahoe and Chamonix. But there's, you know, every establishment now has high-speed Wi-Fi. A lot of the restaurants and bars have electrical plugs that you can plug in to recharge your mobile phones. There are bars that turn into discos at night. There's high-end coffee shops with leather seating. You know, there's even some really good gear stores that they don't gouge the price. They're probably retail price, even though getting them there was on the back of, you know, some animal or even a human. But nonetheless, NOMSI still has a lot of charm that it always has had. You know, I don't know if anybody hears this, knows the answer to this. I'd love to hear it. But I remember the first time I was there to go climb Amen de Blanc is when I saw this market. It's every Saturday they hold a market. And it used to be that people would come in from all over Nepal, including over the pass from Tibet. They would come to this market and it was just a feast for the eyes. You see these huge slabs of meat, colorful baskets of grain and linen, different clothing, Chinese made canvas shoes, which I never have understood how these porters could wear these little flimsy canvas shoes, but still trek throughout. Just amazing, just amazing. But it's just beautiful. To see and to be a visitor and watching it. Like I say, it's like a living Disneyland for the visitors, but you know, it's a way of life for the locals. We're going to spend a couple of nights in NOMSI, and the next day after pulling in, having a good night's sleep, you're going to go take a visit up at what's called the Everest View Hotel. You know, it was built in 1971 by a wealthy Japanese gentleman, and is perched on a ridge at about 12,700 feet. So a little bit higher than NOMSI, and it's a beautiful hotel, beautiful woodwork, just really, really well done. There's a helicopter pad next to it. And at one time, they would fly guests in, and they would, you know, they would fly them in from Kathmandu or wherever. They would fly in, go into the hotel, and a lot of them would get sick because they weren't acclimatized. Today, they have supplemental oxygen. There's only 12 rooms in it, but they've got electric blankets and 12 rooms with running water and hot water showers and of course, Wi-Fi. But the big thing that you do as a trekker or a climber is that you go to the Everest View Hotel because you get, wait for it, a view of Everest. But it's not only a view of Everest, but also it's just this unobstructed view on a clear day of Everest, Lhotse, Noopsi off in the distance. There's Amen de Blanc also, which is ever present, which I talked about last time. And it's just an unbelievable sight. I mean, if you did nothing more than go to the Everest View Hotel and then turn around and go back home, it would be a trip that would change your life. Just beautiful. So you enjoy that day. Maybe you go over to the highest bakery in the world and you go and see the school and around the corner from NOMSI. But whatever it is, that day is an active rest day. I always found that interesting. Active rest day. Either rest or you're active. How can it be both an active and a rest day? Anyway, I digress. So from NOMSI, the next thing we're going to do is we're going to go take a little trek before you start heading down to the very deep path that goes down to the Dodikosi River that you're going to cross. But as you leave NOMSI, the trail kind of, you know, it's fairly wide and it meanders and you kind of go a little bit, maybe half a mile, and then you turn left. And all of a sudden there's this giant stupa in front of you, which is absolutely beautiful. But more impressive than the stupa is then you get this view of Amen de Blanc once again. And you still have views of Everest, Lhotse, and Noopsi off in the distance. Just absolutely stunning. It's virtually impossible to make any time going through this. And I don't know why you'd want to rush through this part. This is where you truly slow down. You slow everything down. Pull out your camera. You take as many pictures as you possibly can because every step offers you a different perspective, a different view. And when you get home, friends and family are go, isn't that the same picture in it? The last same picture you showed us for the last 300 pictures? And I go, yeah, but this one's different. Well, it's different for you because every scene, every step takes you a step closer into the valley and just different views of especially Amon de Blom. Eventually, you go lose the views of Everest, Nuptse, and Lhotse, but Amon will stay with you for quite a while. You know, you go down this really steep path down to the river. You go down there and typically you'll have lunch down there in a village, and I can't pronounce this, Pungai Tenga. And that's a well-deserved break. You probably have fried rice or something like that. And then you're going to regain all of that elevation that you lost to get up to the Tenboche Monastery. You know, in this part of the trek, yeah, it's going to feel long. That by now, you know, you're starting to kind of get your mountain legs because you come up the Namche Hill, you've made that nice little active rest day up to the Everest View Hotel. You've had a couple of good nights sleep now. The jet lag is starting to wane. You're starting to get in, and when your metabolism is adjusting to the altitude, your digestive system is adjusting to the new food. You're trying to be, you're trying to be good in your nutrition and hydration. But still heading up this hill takes a while. Sometimes you leave the trees, and so it can be really, really hot, which is so funny because you started off the day in a down jacket. Now you've got just some t-shirts, and a lot of people have been there multiple times, wear shorts throughout this entire first part of the trek to Everest Base Camp. Not a bad idea. A little cold in the morning, but in the afternoon, you appreciate wearing shorts. Eventually, you start getting higher and higher, and all of a sudden, the trees get a little less dense. And then this archway appears, this wooden archway. And you're like, well, who put a gate here? It's like a scene out of Blazing Saddles or something with the toll gate in the middle of the desert. And all of a sudden you go through that and there's the Tenboche Monastery on your left. In front of it is this beautiful grass field. Typically, there's a handful of yaks that are just grazing around there. You're hearing their bells ringing, and you look over to your left and there's the monastery. It was built in 1916, is burned down a couple of times and hit by earthquake, the latest in 1989. The generosity of volunteers around the world, especially from Germany, actually helped to rebuild the monastery. The inside is hand-painted by monks that come over from Tibet. If you're lucky, you can go in and attend afternoon or morning prayers. The monks are gracious about letting you come in as long as you don't take any pictures and you sit quietly against the wall on these Tibetan rugs. And it's actually pretty cold in there, which explains why the monks are always wearing these big, thick crimson robes. There's some hand-painted windows up. There's this giant Buddha in the monastery, which is typical for a lot of these monasteries. But you just sit there and you listen to the monks go through their rituals and chanting. And it's just, again, it's just a feast. It's just like, you know, seeing those prayer flags flapping and hearing the river. Now you're in a very quiet, serene, spiritual environment, listening to monks practicing their religion. And it's just, I think it's one of the most impressive experiences I've ever had in my life. Well, at that point, you go back down, there's another bakery. Seems like there's a lot of bakeries these days, which is good because you're always hungry and it's great to get a good cinnamon roll and maybe a hot cup of coffee before you head on to the next tea house and you spend the night. Wow. Just talking about this makes me want to go back. It's really, really a significant thing to do, and it will change your life. Climb on. This is Alan. And remember, memories are everything.